dedicate this morning's shir to Reb Reuven Ben Chaim, that is the father of Naomi Gross, whose first yard site is today. So today's shir is sponsored by Mark and Naomi Gross. Naomi actually comes every week, but this week she's not here because she went to visit the kever of her father. So we hope that our Divrei Torah will be an aliyas haneshama for him. What we're going to do today is something that I've actually never done in this venue, but I think it will be meaningful. I hope so. And by way of introduction, I just want to read for you a Gemara in Maseches Yevamos Tzadi Vavam Ben Beis. The Gemara there quotes a pasuk from Sefer Tehillim, where David HaMelech makes a request, and he asks, Agura ba'ahalecha olamim. He asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu a sincere and heartfelt request that he should live in the tents of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in different worlds. So the Gemara asks, V'chiyef shelo la'adam lagar b'shnei olamim. How is it possible for a person to live in two different worlds? Either you live here, in Olam Hazeh, either you're here together with all of us, or you're in Olam Haba. So how can it be that you live in two different worlds? And David HaMelech responds that what he meant by that request was, Ribono shel Olam, yehi ratzon sheyomru davar shmua mipi ba'olam hazeh. I hope, it is my wish, that I will be spoken about in this world, that people will repeat things that they've learned from my life and my legacy. And as that happens, it's as if I myself am living in this world as well. Nobody ever wants to be forgotten. People always want to be remembered. And as a result of that, David HaMelech said, I hope that I made a contribution to the world that is significant enough to be spoken about in future generations. What an amazing request that was. We're still saying the words of David HaMelech so many thousands of years later. We're still repeating his words of Tehillim. And they're so meaningful to us as they have been for so many Jews throughout all the millennia. And from there we learn that it's a schus for a person, after they're no longer here in Olam Hazeh with us, when we give them the opportunity to be remembered, when we give them the opportunity to be spoken about, that is a major schus for them. So this morning happens to be the yard site of the Dubna Magid. The Dubna Magid lived at the end of the 1700s, passed away in 1804, and I have been a major chassid, a major fan of the Dubna Magid. I think he gets shortchanged sometimes, because people think about him, oh, he's just a storyteller, but you don't understand and you don't appreciate how profound the messages of the Dubna Magid may have been. So I thought, just as a schus and aliyas haneshama for him, for a personality that is not appreciated enough, it's an opportunity for us just to learn a little bit from him. And as David HaMelech said, Agura ba'ahalecha olamim, we hope that this will be an opportunity for the Dubna Magid to have an aliyas haneshama, that it should be as if he is here together with us. So the Dubna Magid was a young man living in Ukraine, and there he was giving very small speeches here and there in his community. He was not popular at all. There was a very small group of followers who were listening to him. Oh, it's in the office, if you don't mind. Thank you. He was not so prominent at all until he moves to the city of Dubna. And that was also in the Ukraine, and he's there for 18 years, and he became known as the Dubna Magid. He was known to be a great tzaddik. He was known to be a great personality, so much so that he says about himself that from the day that he was 18 years old, he said he never slept past Chatzos HaLaila. He never slept past midnight, because he always felt that he had a lot to accomplish and a lot to do. I say in the opposite direction. I've never gone to sleep before midnight. But things used to be in the opposite, in the other way. And he said that he never could remember from the time that he was 18 and above, he never could remember a Monday or Thursday that he did not spend fasting. And that is something that is a remarkable virtue that was a part of his life. So the giants of his own generation held him in the highest regard, in the highest of esteem. And they said such really exceptional superlatives when they were describing the life and the legacy of who the Dubna Magid was. And it so much describes what kind of character and influence and personality he was on the generation. When they spoke about him, they said that he was Avi Kol HaMagidim. He was the father. He was the most adept. He was the master in giving over stories and in giving over Mishalim. And Mimizrach Shemesh Ad Muvo Muhulal Shem Kivado. From one end of the world to the other, people were talking about the great contributions of the Dubna Magid. So there's a lot to say about him, but it is well known that in his generation, obviously the towering giant of his time was none other than the Vilna Gaon. They did not live in the same town. The Vilna Gaon lived in Vilna. And the Dubna Magi lived in Dubna, which is a different location. And the Vilna Gaon, who was not just a giant of his generation, he was a giant of generations, had a tremendous affinity toward the Dubna Magid, and very uncharacteristically, he was in the generation of the Vilna Gaon, and very uncharacteristically, the Vilna Gaon sent messages that he very much wanted the Dubna Magid to come visit him, and he felt that he grew, and he was inspired by the messages that were imparted by the Dubna Magid every time that he had visited. And I think what you learn from that is that the Dubna Magid may have been a storyteller. The Dubna Magid may have been a personality who gave beautiful drushas. He was a phenomenal orator. What I think that you learn from that is the Vilna Gaon was not somebody who cared about fluff and about silliness and stories. What the Dubna Magid shared with his generation and with all future generations is not just a charming, fascinating storyteller who used to tell very cute little things. Obviously, what the Vilna Gaon saw in him was something that was extremely substantive, something that was deeply profound, and a very thoughtful and enlightening human being who gave so much to his generation and to ours as well. And I think that that is why it is sometimes a legacy that is not appreciated enough, because he goes down not as a personality who is a major, thoughtful contributor to the generation. He goes down maybe as a storyteller, but his stories give over so much to what our Hashkafa is all about. In his own humility, in his own modesty, the Dubna Magid asked, you know, isn't it a little bit arrogant for me to get up and travel the world and tell stories and give Musar? Who do I think I am? And what gives me the right? It seems almost pretentious to stand up and tell people what to do or give over the Hashkafa as I see it. And the Dubna Magid explained that the reason why he did so is because he said, obviously in his own style, he gave a mashal, and he said, imagine there's a cripple, imagine there's somebody who's incapacitated and he's not able to walk on his own, and he always has somebody who's assisting him, somebody who's helping him. And one fine day, one fine evening, he's sleeping, and he looks out the window at 3 o'clock in the morning and he sees a fire in one of the homes down the block. And he doesn't know what to do because he can't jump out of bed, he can't run away, he doesn't know how to move by himself, and his assistant is sleeping in the other room. So he tries to make some noise, nobody hears him, and finally after a while he goes ahead and he takes out a trumpet and he starts blowing it as loud as he can, and all the neighbors wake up and they say, why are you making so much noise? And he says, look over there, save yourselves, and while you're saving yourselves, maybe you'll save me as well. The Dubna Magid said the same. He said, do I know how to save myself? Do I know how to live life? I'm not sure. But maybe, he said, in the course of my trying to inspire others, maybe somebody will be saved, maybe somebody will be inspired, and maybe, I'll be saved along with them. And that shows the tremendous humility, the modesty of the Dubna Magid. So he was once asked, why is it that you choose to explain everything with a mashal? Why is it that you feel that that is the best way to explain concepts to people? You can just have a conversation without telling a story. Now it just so happens, when you tell a story, people seem to understand it far better, and they have a retention. It's much easier to remember a story than it is to remember a piece of information, which is why, anyone ever read the book Moonwalking with Einstein? Yeah? So if you read that book, you must be a genius. You remember that you read it. So Moonwalking with Einstein is a book, actually, you know who told me to read it? None other than Rabbi Eitan Feiner. He said, you want to remember something in your life? I said, I want to remember things. Like, I don't know how you remember things. So he said, you got to read these books. So that's what the book is all about, remembering. But basically, the gist of the book is that you should make every piece of information in your mind into a story, and then you'll never forget it. Easier said than done. But that's really the idea. So he was asked, why is it that he shares everything b'derech mashal? And he explained as follows. He said, Maisa benar, there was a young child who was deathly sick, and he was very quickly deteriorating. And the doctors were looking, trying to treat him, and they were in deep despair. They were very defeated as they were trying to treat him. Why? Because they had the remedy. They had the medication there. And the problem was the kid wouldn't open his mouth to take the medicine. So every day they come in, they say, look, this is a medication that might not taste good. You may not enjoy it, but I'm telling you, you take it for 3-4 days, you'll be fine. You don't take it, you're going to die of your illness. And they're standing there watching as this child is continuing to deteriorate just because he was insistent that he not take the medication. And this is a tragedy. And the whole family's watching, they don't know what to do. One fine day, the father decides he has an idea. He hires a comedian, he hires an entertainer to come in and make his son very happy. And the son is laughing and he's smiling and he's so excited. And while he's smiling and his mouth is wide open, the doctor goes and injects and squirts in the medication while the mouth was open anyway. The Dubna Magid said that sometimes you need to use that opportunity of opening people's minds and opening people's hearts. And once it's open, you have an opportunity to stick something in. You have an opportunity to inject something that is important that otherwise it's hard for them to listen to. It's hard for them to hear. So he said, sometimes I see myself by telling a story. That's the way to open a person's heart. It's the way to open a person's mind and make them more interested in listening. And once you get that, then the sky's the limit for what you can share with them. But it wasn't like the style of many others. There are some parents and some educators who take the approach of scaring their children, of alarming them, and shocking their kids. You know, last week we had such a beautiful program. I don't know how many of you were here or not here, but unfortunately it was on a Tuesday morning. It was on a Tuesday morning. Unfortunately, the Matzah Shabbos before was that horrific accident outside, and so many members of our community were affected by it on different levels. So I asked Mrs. Kamenetsky, right before we started, I said, how much should we be focusing on this tragedy? I know that there are a lot of high school girls, and we should mention it, we should have mentioned it, we should say till, and we shouldn't say. I just said, tell me what to do. She said, don't give girls another excuse to make drama in their lives. Mention it, say something, and move on. Now again, I don't teach high school girls, and I only have boys in my family. I only have five sons, so I really don't know about female drama that much. My wife is not a dramatic person, so I don't know so much about this. But it's true that sometimes people decide to put drama when they're trying to educate their children, and they'll go to the extreme and say extreme things, and they'll shock their children or their audience by saying that, oh, if you don't do this, you're gonna get punished, you're gonna be that, and the purgatory of Gehenna, and who knows what's gonna happen. And the Dubna Magid felt that that is not at all the way to educate our children, and certainly not the way of a healthy relationship with Avodas Hashem or with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he explained that, as he always did, with a mashal. He said, you always need to be positive, and you need to show your children that life is enjoyable, and that life is supposed to be encouraging for them, and that life should be an optimistic perspective as far as you see it and as far as they should see it as well. And he explained as follows. He said there was a wealthy businessman who got a message one day that he had a package at the port. So he sends one of his attendants in the office to go to the port to pick it up. A couple of hours go by, and finally the attendant makes his way back to the office, and he is so perspired, he's dripping with sweat, and he's so out of breath, and he looks so fatigued, and he's drained, and the attendant walks into the owner of the company and he says, I finally got your package. And without even looking for a minute at what the package is, without even opening it, he says, you picked up the wrong one. He turns to him, he says, how do you know I picked up the wrong one? You didn't even bother to open it. I just spent 3 or 4 hours. He said, that's my point. It happens to be what I was expecting in this package was a box of feathers. It should not have been difficult for you to carry a box of feathers. It should have taken you 2 minutes to go from the port to the office and carry it on your shoulders. No big deal. From the fact that it's so heavy, from the fact that it's so difficult, it's obvious that you picked up someone else's package. And with that, the Dubna Magid explained his perspective on a Jewish life and what it's supposed to look like. And he said, it is not an accident that the way that it is described is Derachea Darchei Noam V'chol Nesivoseh HaShalom. Jewish life is supposed to be pleasant. It's supposed to be refreshing. Jewish life is meant to be invigorating. It's supposed to be an exhilarating experience for all of us. And it's something that should energize us. It's not something that should weigh us down. I have been touched by a comment. I don't know how many people here know David Lichtenstein from Muncie, but I was talking to him a number of years ago. He's a wonderful person, and he mentioned to me that something that bothers him very much about the way that halacha is taught today in many of the schools is, he said, it's mean halacha. Let's see how mean the halacha could be to my life. Let's see how much the halacha could say, you can't do this, and this is wrong, and that's not allowed, and your parents' kitchen is treif, and what you're wearing is not allowed. And he said, halacha is not meant to be mean. Judaism is not meant to show us how awful everything that we do is. It's meant to be derachea darchei noam v'chol nesivoseh shalom. I thought that that was such a beautiful way to explain it. Like, halacha is not mean. It's not meant to be that way, and that's not the perspective we're supposed to have. And the Dubna Magid said that if you're carrying a package, if your Yiddishkeit to you, if what it means is that you're going to be drained and you're going to be perspiring and you're going to be so fatigued and you're going to be holding a load that is just so heavy, it's obvious that you have the wrong perspective. It's obvious that you're just not carrying the right package. It's not what God wants from you. It's not what He wants from any of us. And it's not the religion that He intended for us to be experiencing. You know, people come to me all the time, Bali Ayin Hara, my father just turned 80 years old this past summer. And people say to me, wow, he's 80 years old, like how could it be? He goes away for a Shabbos. You know, he went to Boca Raton, Florida recently, and I asked him in the airport, not this time, last year when he went. He spoke over 30 times from, I think, Tuesday until you had him, right? And you were responsible for some of that. My siblings want to kill you. It's fine. But, you know, he went away and he was speaking not just in Boca, he was speaking in Hollywood and all the different communities. It was over 30 times in one weekend from a Wednesday, I think, to a Monday or Tuesday. It was really insane. And I spoke to my father while he was in the airport in Florida on his way back, and I said, how was it? He said, very relaxing. So I was thinking about it. You know, this is what he loves to do. This is what he does every day of his life. And you can be 80 years old, but that's exactly what the Gemara says, that Ziknei HaTorah, Kol Zman Shemazkinim, Daita Misyasheves. The Torah tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu himself, as he got older, he was 120 years old. It's an old man, right? It's been around for a long time. He's been putting up with a lot of grief of the Jewish people for many, many years. And the Torah says, Lo Naslecho. He didn't get exhausted, and he was invigorated. He was exhilarated by the study of Torah and the involvement in mitzvahs that he had. And that is what the Dubna Magid taught, that when trying to impart messages to our children, when trying to give over what the hashkafa of the Torah in general is to the next generation, we have to make sure that we emphasize not the fear of Gehenna, not how hot it's going to be and how difficult the consequence is going to be if we don't do this and we don't do that. We have to explain and show them that the religion is Derachea Darchei Noam, V'chol Nesivaseh HaShalom. Why is that so hard for us to do? Why is it a message that our children often don't get? And I think the answer to that is found in another comment of the Dubna Magid, where he records a conversation that he had with the Vilna Gaon. And he says he once turned to the Vilna Gaon and he asked him, what is the most compelling way, what is the most effective way to educate others? How are you supposed to do that? And the Vilna Gaon told him that you want to motivate an audience, you want to motivate your children, if you want to inspire and influence them, the answer is as follows. Imagine you have a container, imagine you have a vessel, and you fill it with water, and you continue to fill it with water. If it overflows, automatically all of the other cups around it are going to get wet. And the Vilna Gaon taught him the only way to do that, the greatest way to motivate, the greatest way to teach is to be so overflowing with the concepts that you're trying to impart that everybody around you gets wet from it. So we try to tell our children, you know, it's very important that you daven with a minyan. It's very important that you go to shul. It's very important that you keep Shabbos this way. And it's very important that when I'm talking to you, you pay attention and you're not on your phone. Well, think about it. When I talk to them, I'm on my phone. And when my child is asking me to do homework with them, I'm doing other things and I'm distracted and I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. And I'm not going to shul when I'm exhausted and I'm not showing up to the minyan. So how do I expect that my child is going to have that kind of perspective when I'm not overflowing with that on my own? And the Vilna Gaon taught him that the greatest way to have any kind of influence on another person is to be so overflowing that automatically those around us will get wet by it. Over here, I think when we're trying to give over positive attitudes to our children, we need to realize our children hear the comments that we make. Yes, is preparing for Pesach a difficult task sometimes? Yes, of course it is. Is it difficult to keep Taras HaMishpacha? Yes, it is difficult. Is it difficult to dress in a certain way? Of course it is. But how do we give that over to our children? What do we say about it? Is that all they hear? Do they just hear us kvetching and complaining and saying, Shvertz is ein yid, it's terrible, and this is so difficult, this is not what I want, and I would rather be doing other things? Or do we give over to our children the beauty of what the outcome of it is going to look like? Yes, it's true. Sometimes getting to that point takes work, and it's difficult, and it's not easy. But everything that we want to accomplish in life, we have to invest in. That's the way it goes. You want to become a doctor, and that's been your aspiration and your ambition in life, it's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take you time to go to medical school, to go get your residency, to find the appropriate place for you to be when you become a doctor, and then to build your own reputation. It's not so easy. And there is nothing in life that is easy. And that is really a message that the Vilna Gaon gave over to him. If we want our children to be people who appreciate a life of Torah, a life of Yiras Shamayim, a life of Shmiras HaMitzvahs, a life of Dveikas BaKadosh Baruch Hu, of connection with the Ribono Shel Olam, then we need to show them that that's what we are. They should be getting wet from just being in our presence, from understanding what we value and what it is that we do. There's an amazing Gemara, really an amazing Gemara, where there's a discussion about one of the lines that we say in the beginning of our Shemona Esrei every day. So we know that Moshe Rabbeinu referred to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibar, VeHanor. And as a borrowed term from Moshe Rabbeinu, we now say that in our Shemona Esrei, in the first bracha every day, we say Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibar, VeHanor. The Gemara tells an astounding historical comment. The Gemara says that along comes Yirmiyahu HaNavi, as he's experiencing the Churban Beis HaMikdash and he's watching devastation in front of his own eyes, and he sees how HaKadosh Baruch Hu's house is being burnt to the ground, and he watches as the Jewish people are being kicked out of Yerushalayim, and he says, Nachrim Mekakrim Beheichalo, when I see that there are enemy troops are running around and wreaking havoc in the Beis HaMikdash and destroying the Har HaBayis and doing whatever they feel and kicking the Jews out of their own country, you mean to tell me Hakel HaGadol HaGibar VeHanora, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so majestic, the Ribono Shalom is so eminent? What about him is majestic right now? There is no majesty of the Ribono Shalom. And Yirmiyahu HaNavi takes that line out of the Shemona Esrei. He says, I can't bring myself to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Nora, because in my perception right now, in my perspective, the Ribono Shalom is not majestic at all. I see the reality in front of my eyes, and that is not it. That is the comment of Yirmiyahu HaNavi. If you thought that was bad, along comes Daniel, another one of the Nevi'im, a few years later, and he says, I don't understand. Nachrim mishtabdim bebanav. You have, the Jewish people are now enslaved, and all of their enemies are stronger than they are, and they are empowered by their destruction of the Jewish people. How can you say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Gibor v'hanora? Yeah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so strong and so powerful. He's not powerful. He can't even help a powerless people. He allows them to be destroyed like this. And Daniel decides he's going to take out that sentence of Gibor v'hanora doesn't make sense. So can you imagine? Imagine you look at your Shemona Esrei every day, you say, you know, today I don't have a parnasa. Let me take out the bracha Baruch Aleinu. And today I don't think that all the people who I want to be better are where they should be. So let me take out Rifaenu. It's just not, I'm not feeling it today. So obviously these are the Nevi'im. It's hard to understand exactly what this is all about. But that's what the Gemara says. And along come the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, and they say, no, the Nevi'im got it all wrong. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is HaKel HaGadol HaGibar VeHanora. Even when the Jewish people are in Golos, and even when we're struggling, and even when there's so much suffering in the world. Now, how do you understand that, asked the Dubna Magid? What's the Gvura? The Nevi'im were right. There is no Gvura of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Dubna Magid explained as follows. He says there was a young child who had to go to school. The problem was in his own town, in his own location, there was no school, there was no educational system, there was no infrastructure. But his father wanted to do whatever he could to provide for his son. So he sends his son to a boarding school. But when you go to a boarding school, it's not like today where you have a dormitory. He had to make up with somebody in the town there that he was going to take care of his son. So he said, listen, you seem like a very wonderful person. I'm going to give you X amount of dollars every month, $100 a month. You'll provide my son with all the food that he needs. And we have a deal. Fine. Everything was going fine until a few weeks into this arrangement, the child comes down with an unusual and very rare illness. And he's squeamish and he's nauseous and he can't eat anything. And this man doesn't know what to do with himself. He says, you know, this kid is in my house. He's not my child. I'm trying to take care of him. He won't eat anything. He's famished. And everything I try to do is not helping. So he sends a telegram. He sends a letter back to the family. And he says, look, maybe you should pick your son up. He's really not well. Something's wrong. And I've tried everything. And maybe it's time to come back. A few weeks go by till the letter got there, till they came. And the parents come to pick up the child. And the owner of the house gives him a bill. He says, you know, we made up $100 a month. So the father turns to him, he says, no, $100 a month meant if you were going to feed my child, and I assumed that the food was going to cost X amount every day, so accumulating over a month, that's what it was going to come out to. You haven't fed him anything. My kid hasn't eaten in a month. Why should I give you the money? He says, are you kidding me? With all the treatments and the medications and the doctors and all the interventions, I should be charging you $5,000 a month. It costs a lot more to take care of somebody when they're sick than it does when they're healthy. So he says, you're lucky I'm only charging you $100. That's what we made up. I don't think it's honest of me to give you a bill that's higher. But the truth is, it's much more difficult for me to take care of you, of your son, when he's sick than it was when I thought that he was healthy. And that explains the Dubna Magid is what it means when we say every day in the Shemona Esrei, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibar, VeHanora. What do we mean? The Nevi'im were right. They asked, where's the Gvura of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Where's the majesty of the Ribono Shel Olam? He allows his children to be destroyed. He allows them to be sitting in exile for so many years. That's the Gvura of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Explains the Dibna Magid. It's much easier for the Ribono Shel Olam to look after his people when they're in Eretz Yisrael, when they're in their own place, when they're taking care of themselves. Now that we're in Galus, it costs $5,000 to take care of a patient, much more than the bill that was originally made up. It only would have been $100 had we been in Eretz Yisrael, but here, for the Ribono Shel Olam to sustain the Jewish people and to keep us going throughout the exile with all the difficulties and all the challenges shows and accentuates the Gvura of HaKadosh Baruch Hu even more so than we ever experienced it. This is the greatest miracle. It's a miracle that we would not appreciate as much if we were in Eretz Yisrael, living in our own land, doing our own thing. That's not the experience that we have. And to the contrary, this is how it shows the absolute Gvura and majesty of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that He can take care of us even here, even in the exile, even with everything going against us, that He still continues to sustain us. One of the most basic and fundamental mitzvahs that we have, and it's one of the most difficult and challenging ones, is the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. There is a tremendous expectation that is placed on us as children of how we're supposed to treat and interact with our parents. And sometimes it's very complicated. Sometimes it's very, very difficult. But that's the obligation that we have, which is why the Torah says that somebody who does the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em properly has a bracha of arichas yamim. It's not an easy thing to do. And we deserve a tremendous reward if we are able to do it properly and able to give the respect that our parents deserve. The Gemara does say, though, that although Kibud Av V'Em is of primary importance and it's something we need to think about all the time and do our best to really implement as best as we can, the Gemara does say that should there be a conflict, let's say my parents tell me to do something, but I know that it's against one of the mitzvahs HaTorah. So the example the Gemara gives is, my parents asked me on Shabbos to be Mechal Shabbos. My parents asked me to do something, not that is debatable whether it's against one of the mitzvahs HaTorah, it's clear. My parents asked me to please drive to the supermarket on Shabbos, go shopping, do something, and I know that I'm going to do something that is not permissible on Shabbos, so I have a conflict. On the one hand, I love my parents, I respect my parents, I want to do whatever I can to help them. On the other hand, I love the Ribono Shel Olam, I love God, and I'm not sure where to go with this. So the Gemara says that although Kibud Av V'Em is extremely important, and although you're given the blessing of Arichas Yamim if you do it properly, the Gemara says that when it comes to a conflict between the Ribono Shel Olam on the one hand and my parents on the other hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wins out. That's what the Gemara says. It's learned from Psukim, but that's what the Gemara says. And the Dibna Magid said, why is that the case? Why should that be so? You think my parents are not important? Is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is more important than them? So how exactly does that work? And the Dibna Magid explains it so beautifully with the following interpretation. And he says, the Gemara tells us we have a tradition that Shlosha Shutvim Yesh Ba'adam. There are three components that are the makeup of every human being. There is a father, there is a mother, and there's the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So most people have two parents. We really need to change that way of thinking. We really have three parents. We have our fathers, we have our mothers, and we have HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now ask the Dibna Magid, without any one of those three components, I wouldn't be here. So who is to say that one is greater than the other? Who is to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu means more than my father, that my father means more than my mother, maybe my mother should mean more than my father? How am I supposed to make that determination? So listen how he explains it, and I just find this so eye-opening. He says that there was a family that had three men who were of age to go to university, but they lived in a very small town. And they decided that they were all going to have to go out of town to attend the major university. They really wanted to expand their horizons. They really wanted to advance their careers and educate themselves as best as they can. So the three of them go to university for a couple of years. Each one of them decided that he wanted to go into a different profession. They had different interests. So each one chose a different area of study in the university. The first one was studying science and technology. Obviously, there was no technology in the days of the Dubna Magid, but I'm just updating it a little bit. So the first one studied science and technology, And he learns how to make some kind of telescope where he's able to look into this glass and he could see miles and miles away something that's going on in another community. Right? A video camera. He figures out how to make such a thing. Second one was more interested in engineering. And after all of his studies, he figures out how he can make a high-powered transportation system. He's going to create a car, first one of its kind. And you can go from one location to another without the horse and buggy, without breaking down along the way. It's amazing. And the third one was more interested in medicine, more interested in those sciences. And he becomes a doctor. And he's going into all the different illnesses. He's trying to figure out how he can help save the world and heal different people, different issues that they have. Anyway, they're all very, very highly accomplished. They come back after a couple of years in university, and they all come back home, and they're sharing with their parents all the great things that they learned and all the different inventions that they're capable of doing. And they show their parents, look, I created this car. That's how we got home. The other one says, I created this telescope, this video camera. You're not going to believe it. We can see something on the other side of the country. It's amazing. Third one says, I'm a doctor. Look, I saved all these patients. They were so sick. Anyway, one fine day, they're all sitting around having a discussion. One of them looks into his video camera and he sees that many, many miles away in a distant town, there's a lot of commotion, a lot of excitement, and he tries to zoom in to see what's going on, and he notices that everyone's not really happy, everyone is extremely distraught, and they're very anxious. And he tries to pay attention a little bit more, and he realizes that what's happening is the king's daughter is very, very sick, and there's nobody in the town who can save her. There's nobody who can help her. He goes to his brothers, he says, we're going to take care of this problem. You see, through my video camera, through my technology, I was able to discover the problem. Through your car, we're going to be able to drive there together, and we're going to be able to then use the third brother, who's the doctor, to be able to save this girl's life. Amazing. Can you imagine? This is amazing. Three of them jump in the car, and one of them is looking in his video to see where we're going, how do we get there. The second one is getting all of his medications ready. The third one is driving. They finally get to this location. They push everyone aside. They say, we got it. We have the professional here. And after a couple of treatments, he cures this woman, and she's completely recovered, completely rehabilitated, and the king is beside himself. He can't believe it. Where these people come from? Who are they? They start explaining, listen, we all went to university. We're all very well educated, and we're the best in our fields. You see, I studied technology. I came up with this idea where we can see things very far away. And my brother studied engineering, and he came up with this car, with this mechanism. We got here as quickly as we could. And the third brother went to med school, and it's amazing. Look what he did. And all of us together, we put our heads together, and we saved the daughter. The king says, look, I don't even know how to repay you. I don't know what to say. I guess the best thing I can do is one of you is allowed to marry my daughter. Look, you saved her life. And a huge fight breaks out. And they don't know who's deserving of this princess. Who should marry her? Well, the first one says, if not for me, we never would have even known that there was an issue here. You see, I'm the one who identified the problem. I saw something that none of you were able to see. So maybe I should be the one who has the privilege of marrying the princess. Second one says, as much as I appreciate that, you could have seen whatever you saw, but without my car, without my scientific intervention that I came up with, there's no way we would have gotten here in time. She would have died. It would have taken us 3 years to get here. Third one says, you're all wonderful. Had you seen and identified the problem, had you driven in your car to get here, nothing would have happened if you didn't have a doctor with you who can actually save the girl's life. And they're having this argument back and forth. Who's worthy of marrying the king's daughter? They don't know what to do. Finally, the king turns to his princess and he says, do you have a particular interest in any of the three? You know, they all are very talented young men. Maybe you're interested in one over the other. And she says, look, I understand. You're all amazing. You're all extremely talented. You all saved my life together. But here's the thing. Should I have a problem in the future, I don't need any of you. I only need the doctor. So I think that's the one I'm going to stick with. Because it doesn't help me to have the video camera somewhere else, and it doesn't help me to have the car. What helps me now is, now that we're here, if I get sick in the future, I'll have the doctor to cure me. And of the three of you, that is the most important of all of this group. Explained the Dubna Magid, we cannot say that our father, our mother, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is more important, less important. Without any of these indispensable partners, we would not be here. Obviously, Shlosha Shutvim Ba'adam, there are three components to the creation of every human being. Without HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention, without a father, without a mother, nothing would happen. So we need all three components. And all three are deserving of our attention as children. We owe everything to all of them. After all, they all made us who we are in very different ways, but everybody infused into our lives. Now it comes a conflict, and I have to make a decision. Am I going to show my allegiance to A, B, or C? Which one should it be? It doesn't always work out that I can show equal respect to everybody. It doesn't happen that way. So here I have to make a decision and a choice. Who is it going to be? HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me, keep Shabbos. My parents are telling me, don't keep Shabbos. Who should I listen to? I love my parents. I respect my parents. I love the Ribono Shel Olam. I respect him. The answer is, although it's true that without any one of those three components, I wouldn't be here. But going forward, should you have a problem, it's only one of them who's going to take care of you. There's only one of them who can absolutely reassure you that your problem is not a problem. And that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he says that is why the Gemara says that when you have such a conflict, when you have such a decision and a choice to be made, it is the Ribono Shel Olam that must come first. It's not because we don't respect our parents. It's not because we don't care about them. It's not because we don't show honor and dignity to everything that they represent and stand for. But when we have a conflict and a decision needs to be made, sometimes it's a difficult one, but it's the right one to be made. Which leads to an additional point. You know, we say in Sefer Tehillim, Hodu la Hashem ki tov, ki li olam chasdo. So, I'm not like reading one thing of the Dubna Magid. These are like 100 different places that the Dubna Magid says all these different things. It's just over the years, things that have made a tremendous impact on my way of thinking. So I hope it's interesting to you. So the Dubna Magid, you can tell me afterward if it's not. So the Dubna Magid writes, what does it mean when we say, Hodu la Hashem ki tov, ki li olam chasdo? He says, there were two people in a town who both wanted to start a business venture, but neither of them had money. So they had to go to somebody who had capital, who was able to invest in them. And they go and they ask for a temporary loan. This one says, you know, I want $10,000, $20,000. I'm trying to open this business. I'm trying to get it off the ground. I just don't have that kind of money right now. Would you be willing to help me? He says, of course. I want you to be successful. I want you to be helped. And I'll do whatever it takes. So he gives him the $20,000 loan. Next day, another person comes, gives him a $20,000 loan as well. And he says, you have a month to pay it back. Now, after a month, obviously, they both need to pay it back. They don't want to pay interest. So they both need to pay back the loan. And they understand that, that there's a due date, there's a time when they have to pay, and there's no cutting corners, there's no way around it. But one of them goes to the person who loaned him the money, and he says, you know, I have to tell you, I'm just so overwhelmed, I'm so appreciative for everything you've done for me. You don't understand how helpful this was. You don't understand how much this did for me, for my family. You know, I have not been able to get off my feet. I've been trying for so many years, I couldn't get anywhere. And you finally came to my assistance and you did it with such graciousness and you were so kind and so benevolent as we went through the negotiation. You were just so nice about it. And I'm really grateful. I just want to say, now that it's a month and I've been able to make enough money to give back that which I borrowed, I just want to repeat over and over again how grateful I am to you. And the second one does not have the same feelings. He says, look, I have to pay back the loan, but you know, I don't really recognize what he's done. You know, after all, he's a wealthy guy anyway. What's the difference? He didn't even notice. $20,000 less in his bank. He doesn't even pay attention to it. Doesn't make a difference. Ask the Dubna Magid, what's the difference between these two people? In the end of the day, they both paid back. They did what they were supposed to do. What's the difference? Where will the difference be shown between these two personalities, between these two perspectives? And he explains as follows. Imagine if that person moves out of town in the course of the 30 days. Or that person is no longer, let's say I borrowed money from a store, and now the store goes out of business. So I have to pay it back. I owe money to the owner, to the provider. But now the store is out of business. So what happens after that takes place? Explains the Dubna Magid. If I'm the kind of person that is just giving back the money because I'm so grateful for someone else's generosity, for someone else's thoughtfulness, for someone else's willing to give me and help me, I'll give it back regardless of the circumstance. I understand that I owe it. I understand that I owe this person everything I have. Of course I'll give to them. Doesn't matter whether they moved out of town, I'll make sure to find them. But what if I'm that person who is paying back only because I need to, not because I'm grateful for everything they've done? Well, now that the store is no longer a business, or now that the person moves out of town, And in the future, I'm never going to have to rely on their favors again because they don't live here. And I'm never going to have to interact with them again. So I'll push off the payments. I'll do it another time. I'm not going to have to confront you every day. It doesn't really matter. Explain the Dibna Magid. We owe everything in our lives to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But there's two ways of saying that. Hodu LaHashem Ki Tov. Number one, we should thank the Ribbono Shel Olam because He's good to us. He gave me life. He gave me a family. He gave me a parnasa. He gives me a house to live in. These are not givens. Look around the world and see how many people do not have healthy life. See how many people do not have a parnasa. See how many people do not have a home to live in. Look what's going on in the world. Look out there and see how blessed we are. So thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ki Tov. No strings attached. Just be grateful because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so good to me. But then, think about also, Ki Li Olam Chasdo. Think about the rest of the journey of your life, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will continue to be good for you. So if for no other reason other than that, it's good to be grateful to Him anyway, because you're going to have to keep on relying on Him. Even if you don't fully understand or appreciate Ki Tov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's so good, I don't always see it. But Ki Li Olam Chasdo, you're going to have to ask Him for a loan again. You ask for the loan to get your business off the ground, you're going to have to rely on Him again. And going further in your life, you're going to have to keep on relying on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why the Dibna Magid says, David HaMelech phrases it this way, Hodu LaHashem Ki Tov, Ki Li Olam Chasdo. On the one hand, thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu simply because He's provided me with so much good in my life. But beyond that, Ki Li Olam Chasdo, just, it makes sense. It makes sense because you're going to have to rely on Him over and over again in the rest of the course of your life. And that is an opportunity for us to realize how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu infuses into all of our lives. This is a very difficult Maimer Chazal. Chazal tell us it's hard to explain on a most basic level what Chazal are saying. We say every day, V'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha. You should love HaKadosh Baruch Hu with your whole heart. Okay, it sounds wonderful. It sounds really nice. But the Medrash writes, Eni yodea echu oives hamakom. How are you supposed to love the Ribbono Shel Olam? What does it mean? So the Medrash tells us, Kishu Omer, when the Torah says, V'hayu ha'dvarim ha'ela al levavcha, that these words, that the mitzvahs and the Torah should be on your heart, that's what it means, V'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha. How do you explain what that means? You're supposed to love God, it should be on your heart. How is that to be understood? And the Dibna Magid explained as follows. He said, there was a manufacturer who was making suits and all kinds of clothing. And he has a store, and he puts out all the different merchandise out in the front of the store that people should see it. Somebody comes to town, and he's looking for a suit. So he walks into the store, and he says, you know, I really don't have a lot of time. I'm running to a meeting, but my suit ripped on the way as I was coming on the train. Actually, just had this. It was a funny thing. Not so funny, actually. I was asked to speak in the summer. Did I say this here? Not sure. I learned a big lesson from it. So I was asked to speak in the summer by a big event, interesting event, that was hosted on President Trump's golf course in Westchester. Okay, interesting. And he was the main speaker, and I was the other speaker. So it was fascinating. I'm not a politician. I don't do these things. I was just asked to speak very briefly. Okay. So I come to this thing, very, very elaborate event, and there were only 5 Jews there, I think, and hundreds of other people, and they had ordered kosher food for us, but it was a little bit degrading for them to bring out the kosher food and the wrappings and the packages. You know, they didn't want to bring it out there, so they bring us inside to a room. They said, yeah, all of you, you'll sit inside, really nice. And they made us very comfortable. It was very nice. And it was boiling hot outside, 80 degrees. I was thrilled to be going inside into the air conditioning. I wasn't interested in talking to anybody who was there anyway. It didn't interest me at all. So anyway, we go inside, and the waiter brings out this meal that's wrapped in wrappings and more wrappings. Anyway, so I see the 3 other people that are with me who paid like a lot of money to be there, upwards of $25,000 to be there. So the 3 other people who are there are unwrapping this thing, and then I see them eating, you know, eating in the pan. I'm like, that's so strange. Why would you eat in a pan? Like, so weird. So I asked, I didn't say it to them. I said to the waiter, would you mind bringing me a plastic plate? Like, you know, I'll take the food out, put it on a plate. Okay. He says, sure. Brings me a plate. And I take the chicken out of this pan. I put it on the plate. First cut with the knife. Thing slides right off the plate all over me. And then I understood why these people eat in their pans. I get it. It only has to happen to you once, and then you don't make that mistake again. And here I am. I'm about to stand up and speak with the President of the United States, and I look like a mess, and I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. It's the craziest thing. So somebody turns to me and says, "You don't keep an extra shirt in your car?" I'm like, "No. It's never happened to me in my life. I've never spilled anything on my shirt, let alone a piece of chicken and meat that's all over my shirt." Anyway, the good news was it was 80 degrees outside. I was so hot when I got in there, I took my jacket off. I'm like, "Watch this." Put my jacket on. Perfect. It was all over my shirt over here. Guy's like, "Hey, why don't you loosen up a little?" I'm like, "No, not today. Thank you." Anyway, so it was fine. My point in saying that was, I'm not sure. My point was that, you know, I was in a bind and I had nowhere to buy a suit. So this man is traveling through town. He says, "I have a very important business meeting. I need to wear a suit. My suit ripped on the train as I was coming here. I don't know what to do." He says, "No problem. Look at the store. We have plenty of clothing for you. Don't, you know, you're not going to be in a bind. It's not going to be a problem at all." Anyway, so he walks in right away without even measuring him. They say, "This is your size. This is perfect for you." And he says, "I trust you. This is what you do all day." He goes to the back, puts the suit on, and before he even finishes putting it on, he's like, "You guys are a sham. This suit doesn't fit me. What are you, crazy? This is my measurement. This is not the size for me." And they're looking at him. "We've outfitted hundreds of people here before. We take one look at you. We know exactly what you need. We know exactly what size you are. What do you mean it doesn't fit you?" Back and forth, back and forth. Finally, someone says, "You fool. You didn't take your old suit off. You're trying to fit into a suit when you're wearing old clothing without taking them off. How do you think it's going to fit you? Of course it's not going to fit." The Dubna Magid explained that's what it means when this Medrash says, "V'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha b'chal levavcha." We're given a tall order to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu with all our heart. Ask the Dubna Magid. You look at that and you say, "How am I supposed to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It's an impossibility. How am I going to do that? I have so many things in the way. I'm wearing the old clothing. I do so many different things that get in the way of my ability to have an Avas Hashem. That suit of godly love in my life doesn't fit. Why doesn't it fit? Because I'm wearing an old suit. Lots of old suits. Lots of other clothing that get in the way between myself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu." Writes the Medrash, you know what it means? The answer to how you're supposed to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, put it al levavecha. Get all the other things out of the way between yourself and your heart, and put HaKadosh Baruch Hu there. And the moment you do that, it will no longer be a difficult task for you to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's there for the taking. It's easy. It's something that is attainable for all of us. I see we're out of time, so let me just close with one final comment. We can continue next week if you want. I have another 10 pages to talk about. But there's a comment of the Dubna Magid that I was always touched by, where he says a story about a man who was summoned to a court hearing by the Russian authorities. And this man is petrified. He's terrified. We've all heard these stories. And he begins to seek counsel and advice from all of his closest friends and neighbors, and he doesn't know what to do. And they direct him. There's one prominent lawyer who's had much, you know, a lot of experience dealing with the authorities. They know how to take care of this. He's had decades of experience in taking care of members of our community who have issues with the Russian authorities. And although they're very tough and they're very powerful, when they see him walk into the room, they know that there's a problem. They know that the lawyer is going to push back. They know that it's not going to be as simple as they thought. And he goes and he seeks counsel from this lawyer. The very first conversation, the lawyer begins by saying, "You know, I have a retainer fee. Just to get involved in a case, you should understand there's $200,000 before we get started." He says, "Look, my life is on the line. I'm going to lose my life. My children are not going to have a father. I don't have a choice. What should I do? I don't have $200,000, but I guess that's my only option. I'll have to borrow money for the rest of my life to pay for this." So he doesn't see any other viable option other than retaining the lawyer, and that's what he does. And he makes a commitment, and he begins to discuss the details of the case. After a few minutes of conversation, the lawyer says to him, look, you know, you really have a problem. You have a problem because there's no way we're going to win the case. There's only one way out. The only way out is if you plead insanity. If we're going to start arguing the details of the case, you're going to be guilty. The only way out for you is pleading insanity. So here's the plan. When the judge stands up and puts you on the witness stand, when the judge starts asking you pointed questions, the only thing you could do is jump out of your seat and start barking like a dog. And you just keep jumping up and down. You look like a total insane person. And every time he asks you another question, just do the same thing. And don't ever let up that you're putting on a facade, that you're putting on a fake. This is what you have to do. And after a few of these lunatic experiences, the judge will realize, obviously, that you're insane. And that's the only way we're going to save you. The plan worked like a book. They go to court the next day. And the judge starts asking him questions. He starts barking at the judge. Judge asks him another. He says, "Excuse me, sir, did you hear me?" He starts jumping out of his seat, jumping over the tables. Judge can't believe what he's seeing. He's like, "Listen, this man is insane. There's no way that he did this crime. It's just he doesn't have the mental capacity to even do such a thing." He lets him off. Lawyer shows up the next day at this man's door and he says, "Listen, I told you it would work. How was that? Now I'm here for the payment." The man starts barking at him and jumping up and down. The lawyer says, "Excuse me, did you hear me? We made an agreement. You're going to give me at least $200,000 was the retainer fee. Forget about all the hours I spent with you in court." And he confronts him and he says, "You owe me this enormous sum of money." And just starts jumping over the tables, jumping out of his seat, making all kinds of crazy noises. The lawyer turns to him and he says, "Excuse me, sir. You can't pull that trick on me. I was the one who taught you that. You're going to use my stunt against me? That doesn't work." The Dubna Magid said, "You know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a lot of incredible gifts in our lives. One of them is the gift of forgetting. Imagine if we would remember every single time somebody says a nasty comment to us. Imagine if you were a rabbi, right? And every nasty email that you got, you actually remembered and you didn't just delete. What would you do? What would you do? Imagine if every ounce of Agmas Nefesh that our children ever gave us in our lives was something we remembered. It's a gift that we forget. It's a gift. People hurt us. People do the wrong things. People are ingrateful. People say something that is very hurtful. And we forget over time. Time heals. It's a gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, that we have the ability to forget. Life would be impossible if not. And that being said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says in Parshas Ha'azinu, "I gave you the gift of forgetting, that you shouldn't have a life of Agmas Nefesh, that you shouldn't have a life of pain, that you shouldn't have that raw memory of those terrible things that happened to you. And what did you do with that gift? Batishkach kel mechololeka. You use that trick against me? You use that gift of forgetting to forget me? You used your gift of forgetfulness to forget that the Ribono Shel Olam exists in the world? You go about your day and never think about the fact that I'm here? How dare you? That's a trick that I taught you. That's a gift that I gave you. It's not something that you can use against me." And the Dubna Magid explains that so often that is the experience of our lives. That we forget how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu is meant to be a presence. The Ribono Shel Olam tells us, the Navi describes, how the Ribono Shel Olam also sometimes has selective memory. There are certain things that he chooses to forget. The Navi says, "Gam eile tishkachna, v'anochi lo eshkachech." You know what that means? "Gam eile tishkachna," Chazal say, when did we use that very important phrase, "eile"? When we were dancing around the Egel and we said, "Eile Elohecha Yisrael." And we showed our allegiance to a God other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Ribono Shel Olam says, "Gam eile tishkachna." I'm willing to forget that. I'll move on from that experience. "Va'anochi lo eshkachech." HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "I'll never forget the moment of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. When you as a Jewish people were willing to pledge your allegiance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nasa v'nishma. Who does such a thing? Anochi lo eshkachech." HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "I also have selective memory. Certain things about your history, about your past, I'm willing to overlook. I'm willing to forget. Other things I will never forget. But don't ever forget that I'm the one who gave you the gift of forgetfulness. I'm the one who gave you that allowance to let things slide, to let things go, to allow time to heal certain things that are painful to you in your life. Don't you dare ever use that," says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, "against me. Batishkach kel mechololeka." You took that gift of forgetfulness and used it against the Ribono Shel Olam himself. Again, these are just some of the highlights of thousands and thousands of pages of uplifting stories and messages of the Dubna Magid. Again, I hope, like the Gemara says, "Agura ba'ahlecha ulamim." We hope that the words that we share today will be something that should be an Aliyas HaNeshama for the Dubna Magid, who was such a towering giant, who gave so much into the infusion of what our Hashkafa is all about, of what our lives are supposed to be. And I feel in so many ways he's framed the way that we give over messages, the way that we inspire, the way that we're supposed to educate our children, our communities, our audiences. And it's something, Yehi Zichro Baruch, I hope that all that we share today will be something that gives honor and dignity to his name. Amir Tashem, next.